Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 160, being recorded on the 4th of January, 2017, with special guest Mark Eisenberg. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest, Mark. And as usual, before we get talking to Mark on a very interesting topic, let's just do a quick roundup on the Azure news. Well, before that, Happy New Year, guys, and Happy New Year to all our listeners. I hope you guys had something fun bringing in the new year. Kale, what were you doing?
I was selling my house.
Now, you live around New York City, but not in New York, not in Manhattan, correct?
Yeah, I'm out in Queens.
In Queens, okay. So you didn't have to deal with all that madness.
Yeah. No, I didn't go in for a Times Square or anything. We just did it here at the house, you know.
Okay.
But I let the champagne get really warm, and like when I took the wire off the top, I mean, I was even holding my finger over the cork, and that thing came out of there pretty hard.
That's awesome. See, I went totally the other way. We did nothing. I set my oof to tell everybody at Microsoft that I was not reading email, and when I came back, if they sent me one while I was oof, I was not going to read it. And I came back on Monday, Tuesday, my first day back, to two emails that people sent me that they said, hey, I tried to reach you over the holidays. This is important. I need you. Nothing else. It was one of the most relaxing time off I've had, because not only do I lose all that work debt that was there, but I didn't pick up any new work debt when I came in. So that's awesome.
That's a nice way to start the year, no doubt.
Oh, it absolutely is. How about you, Sujit?
We have a tradition in our family. We just like to sit down and watch that show, the Dick Clark Show, right? We watch all the, you know, we get to see all the performers and whatnot, and then we watch the ball drop, and after that, you know, I drop off to sleep, and my wife and I will drop off to sleep, and the kids will just hang on for a little bit longer, and we get the fire going and things like that. So that's our thing. Although this year, as you guys probably heard, it was a bit of a it didn't go so well for some of the performers on the stage. So interesting evening, but yeah, that's what we did, and that's we did the same thing this year. So that was all good.
Cool, excellent.
And well, I mean, Mark, what did you do on New Year's?
For New Year's, about the same as you, except we watched Kathy Griffin and Anderson Cooper goof off on CNN. I missed the whole musical fiasco.
You didn't miss anything, but I think you probably got the better of it. Okay, great. All right, so then, Evan, I think what you said is true, though. It's been a quite week, right? Even the news this week has been kind of light.
Absolutely.
I think Kale and you put some notes in there in the show notes, but nothing too much. What do you want to talk about? There's a couple of items there.
For me, you know, again, you know, because I'm sure Kale's going to have something about blockchain. we got some, you know, again, SQL Azure is picking up some, you know, brand new features for the memory optimized stuff, right? This is the really high performance stuff that's come out in SQL Server 2016 on-prem. Got some new JSON stuff, and which obviously everybody on the web uses, as well as, again, some additional things, some memory optimized stuff. This is just like, again, this is the story we had Bob Ward on talk about, right? Something ships in on-prem, you see it in Azure a little bit later. Something ships in Azure, you see it in on-prem, and this is just, you know, yet another example of that.
Yep, and there's quite a few features that they're shipping all in public preview now.
Yeah.
That's great. So, Kale, what about you? What did you like on that list?
The blobs. I don't think we talked about this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the general availability of the larger block blobs.
Those are huge blobs now. What the heck do you put in a file that big?
I was wondering the same thing, like 4.77 terabytes. I know a use case.
Yeah, 4.77 terabytes. They, one, I can tell you a use case right off the top of my head that I know of is DNA sequences. They're over a terabyte in size. And,
yeah, but that's a terabyte. Well, I guess at that point you might as well go to 4.7 is probably some magic number somewhere. It matches something.
Yeah.
You know, so okay, so maybe that was just, we didn't want to go to 2 terabytes, 4.7. 4.77 just seems like, how did you come up with that number? But it's, that's, I mean, a huge increase from where we were, from 195 gigs. Right, I mean, that's just...
Yeah.
And just to be clear, this is just for the block blobs. Right.
Yeah.
This is not for the page or the append blobs.
Yep.
And to be clear, just so people are like super geek out here on the block blobs, so you know this is close to 5 terabytes now, but it's still 50,000 blocks. So essentially, raise the block size. So they were maximum 4 meg before, now they can be 100 meg.
Yeah. Right.
So if you do the math there, yeah.
Yep.
So you get close to 5 TB. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess you could still do the whole block blobbing thing, right? Where you can just put individual blocks in between.
Yep.
So you don't. It doesn't mean you have to rewrite the whole 5 terabyte file, or whatever.
Yeah.
If that's what you have to do.
But that initial upload is going to hurt.
Yes.
Azure. What is it? It's the Azure Import Export Service is your solution there. Ship us some drives.
But that's a good point that Shajid about the block blobs, not to kill this, but like it's not page blobs, so keep that in mind about, you know, VHDs.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And then there was one more thing about the general availability of the VNet peering in some of the other regions, which weren't covered before. Germany, U.S. government, and China, they got that. And I guess... do you see that a lot, Evan, in your...
Absolutely. It's actually one of the... Yeah, so the Azure networking team, this is actually one of the most common asks that they get these days, because historically, right, if you want to do this, you had to basically set up the equivalent to site-to-site between your two VNets, right? You got extra gateways, there's, you know... The service all manages it, but you got a perf hit, and there's caps, and all this kind of... Now we basically, what we... VNet peering is basically saying, hey, we're going to put in the routing rules that allow your VM in one VNet to talk to your VM in another VNet, just like it talks to VMs in the same VNet. It's actually implemented the same way. And so it's like you lose all the blocks that the site-to-site implementation basically puts on you. And it's, to be honest, it's easier for us to, you know, these days, that's a huge win. It's very, very popular and very common.
That's good. So now that's available pretty much in most of the regions, which is a good thing.
Yeah, this is all the sovereign clouds.
Yeah.
Right? These are the kind of isolated ones that are not public Azure. So yeah, this is just those coming up to par with the public stuff.
Great. Okay.
One that stuck out to me there was Sajid, the Node.js. So there was, I guess there's been a lot of advancement there in the different services that we support Node.js in now. Beyond just the normal stuff that we had before with like app service and things. So basically there's a lot of new features there. You can take a look at the blog post, but around VMCL sets with Linux-based Node.js stacks, there's container infrastructure with ACS, and so a lot of different more, you know, features where you can use Node.js inside Azure.
So it's become pretty much a first-class citizen then now, almost.
Yeah.
There's always been this discussion we've had, right? What's the performance of Node.js versus ASP.NET? Have you guys heard that before? that kind of comes up all the time. And,
yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. And yeah, some people say Node.js is like kind of like an interpreted language, whereas .NET can be compiled into native and things like that. Do you guys, Evan, Kale, do you guys see that a lot?
I this probably would have been a question back when I was in dev support. Like we hated Node back then, so I've not run into it personally. I've just been too far away from that space. But it wouldn't surprise me in the least. I don't know the answer. Do you?
I mean, we use a lot of it, especially in the open source with all the stuff we've been doing with Linux and the open source stuff. I mean, we use a lot of it in DX, and yeah, I use it daily. When we spin up a service, you know, it's one of the first ones that we approach. But I mean, there is some things to think about though with it, like there's all these different ways to run it. I think there's a Shocker core that they mentioned in this article, but the big issue with Node before was it was single-threaded. And that Chakra stuff that we had worked on was basically a way to enable the multi-threading. And there's other ways to make it behave like multi-threading, but that was one of the big things. The other thing was there was always a bunch of things you had to do when it was 32 versus 64-bit, and so you kind of had to play with that stuff a little bit, but it's getting better.
Yeah. I mean, I've always heard that Node.js is obviously, if you run it on Linux, it runs really fast. Right, because that's where it was originally. I guess the JavaScript engines really shine on Linux. On Windows, apparently, I think ASP.NET could be faster than Node.js. So that's what I've heard.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's good. That's a good roundup of all the news. So let's get to our special guest, Mark. And just you know, you guys are probably wondering how I got Mark on this show. He and I were at a customer meeting just before the holidays, actually, and you know, he struck me as a very opinionated fellow when it comes to all things cloud, you know. But specifically,
I'm taking that as a compliment.
It is a compliment, Mark, meant in no other way. But specifically, when it came to the topic of Service Fabric and microservices and things like that, he was even more opinionated. So I asked him if he would come on the show and give us his thoughts, because I think he has some very good ideas and very good thoughts on this topic, and obviously the Service Fabric, as you know, is really picking up in popularity, and this is something that I think is important for our listeners to understand about the place of Service Fabric in their overall, you know, application design. So thank you, Mark, for joining. And please, you know, give our listeners a quick intro about your background, and then we'll kind of dive into the topic there.
All right. So I've been a developer for a long time, too long, but I gave it up full-time 27 years ago. Because as I used to tell people at the time, I got tired of people who made more money than me, that weren't as smart as me, making promises that I had to work weekends to fulfill. So that got kind of old. And long story short, I came into Microsoft in 2006. I was in Premier Support, and then got an opportunity to join the, what I like to refer to as, nascent Azure sales team back in 2009. There were just four of us in the U.S. then. So I'm a veteran of the PaaS v1 cloud services wars.
That might be where I know your name from, Mark, because I've been hanging around this space for about that long as well. I think we've run into each other.
Yeah, your name is very familiar. We crossed paths somewhere. I can't remember where.
But
sure.
I mean, back then there was just a handful of us, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. So,
okay.
Yeah, I actually left the company for a couple of years. The IS thing wasn't really doing much for me. And around the time that I was recruited back into services, so I'm in Premier Support for developers now, the Service Fabric thing was starting to happen. And as a developer, and I think, Sujeet, I told you this thing, that I considered the Service Fabric thing probably the coolest thing we've ever done, and it may be the coolest thing that's ever been done in our industry.
Wow.
In terms of just, as a developer, all of the stuff that needs to be done that I don't have to deal with, you know, with the replication and all that type of stuff. The idea of moving the data tier up into the middle tier, because two of my least favorite things in the world are sticky load balancers and caches, not necessarily in that order. And the Service Fabric gives us the potential to basically get rid of all of that.
So
that's a pretty sweeping statement, Mark.
Which one? The coolest thing we've ever done statement?
No, that's go ahead, Evan. Are you going to say something?
I was just gonna say. I mean, I'll pick on Sajid a little bit because Sajid has his service fabric glove, like Kale and I have ours. But like, I hear this from Sajid, like hearing this from somebody that's on the field is really cool. This, I mean, is it really that? I don't want like that revolutionary. I mean, like if I just missed how revolutionary this is, I knew it was cool and did some nice things, but like the level of things you're heaping on it really says, hey, I mean, I need to go pay more attention to this.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite stories is right after Build, when we introduced it, I did a presentation for the Azure User Group here in Boston, and we had a brand new DX guy. He'd been with the company about a month, and he was sitting pretty far over to my right. And I had just gone through the slide. It's the animated slide, or the one with the build that shows how, I think it's the one where a node fails and how the secondary is automatically promoted to a primary, and then you rehydrate a new secondary. And I got done with that, and all of a sudden I just heard, wow! And I looked at him and I went, I know, right? Because it's that kind of stuff, you know, that we've been battling with, even in the Windows world, you know, for two decades. And this is all just part of the platform now. And then the database thing, it's, you know, if you guys would probably agree, like 80% of what SQL is used for, you don't actually need something with the power of SQL. There are way more straightforward ways to do it. In fact, when Sujit and I were having that customer meeting last week, they were like really reticent to give up on the idea of a data tier, and they said, we're going to do document DB. I was like, that's key value pairs, right? And I said, yeah. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of what a reliable collection is, a reliable dictionary. So why don't you just skip all of that? You know, but that's how entrenched everybody else is in the old way. And I've always tried to embrace a better way, you know, because what we're doing right now is not that great. It's really complicated and it's really expensive and it's hard to scale. And in my world in support, you know, this concept of technical debt, these companies that are running 10, 12-year-old software, or if you look at what it took everybody to get off of Windows XP and to land with a big thud on Windows 7, where they're now, in a few more years, going to have to do it all over again. And the service fabric, which enables microservices, and the microservices is what really gives us the agility in software to support the changing needs of the business, and I've been around a long time, and the business needs change at an ever-increasing pace. That is not hype. That is reality. That's what's happening. Lots of things like big data and machine learning, I think, are hype, but the faster change of business is real.
Okay. I'm impressed.
So you know, I guess let's just start by understanding, you mentioned both Service Fabric and microservices. And obviously, the way you look at them, they're kind of tied at the hip. So, what's the relationship between the two? How would you quantify that?
The Service Fabric is a platform on which to run microservices, or really to deploy microservices, and it takes care of all of the management aspects of microservices. It's that simple.
Okay.
I used to describe PaaS V1 as it's just another deployment option. Instead of deploying onto Windows Server, you would deploy into cloud services.
So you consider this to be PaaS V2 then? Is that the way you're considering it?
Yeah, I'm looking at it as PaaS V2. We have to be careful with that because some of the functionality of PaaS V1, for instance, from an operational perspective, the auto updating of the operating system isn't there with the Service Fabric yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the roadmap, but apparently all these other little, I was talking to a product group guy prepping for the meeting last week, and he referred to it as we need to buff off some of the sharp edges.
Mm.
And those sharp edges are the things that make it a little more difficult for our big conservative enterprise customers to try to leverage the Service Fabric. So these other really important things are getting pushed into the background, and I'm hoping that they're going to come forward soon. And then, yes, it can really be PaaS V2. Because you remember, one of the problems with PaaS V1 is the granularity of a virtual machine was too big. it was too much for many workloads, you would wind up with a whole lot of resource out there when you didn't really need it. So the microservices along with the service fabric's kind of container strategy, you know, makes all of that work.
So the density is higher with service fabric.
Much.
Can be higher. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the agility of the microservices comes in that small size, that lower granularity or higher granularity.
Hey, Mark, I'm going to get your opinion on when you're implementing this, or if customers are looking to say, hey, I want to use Service Fabric. I'd say one of the, I won't call it a negative, we'll just call it like an implementation detail, is that you have to change your code a bit, right?
Yeah.
In order to really take advantage of this. So, you know, you look at that and weigh that versus technology that says, oh, you don't have to change your app. We can just run this thing in this unique way and kind of try to do it on the infrastructure side. This is more focused on, let's put a little bit more work in the coding side, and then the thing becomes more resilient, scalable, et cetera.
Right. And really, the thing you just mentioned is kind of how we got into this mess in the first place. The fact that we as developers would build something and then throw it over the wall, and we would basically, the IT guys had to basically put enough stuff underneath it to make it reliable and scalable. And that just doesn't work very well. The microservices kind of force a more collaborative approach there. And yeah, absolutely, the code's got to get better in order that we get better operational performance. And companies like Netflix figured that out a while ago.
So I'm now officially coming out against Service Fabric, because if we do this successfully, I'm in support. I'm out of work here. Right?
Come on, be an ADM.
I mean, seriously, you know, and you guys, you know, again, I don't know if you guys have caught that. I mean, really, a huge chunk of my living in developer support was customer was just like they didn't put enough hardware under it, or the app wasn't really designed to scale, and nobody had tested it, and like. They were urgent, critical, important cases, but they were never really hard. Oh, well, your CPU's hitting 100%. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And I think, Mark, you still have to think about those things with Service Fabric, right? I mean, in terms of this, it makes it easier to scale, but you still have to plan how big your infrastructure is going to be. Because at the end of the day, you have X number of VMs that are going to run your Service Fabric cluster. And the number of VMs that you allocate to them is going to determine how much you can actually throw at that particular setup.
Yeah, so a couple of things there. One, when we look at DevOps, it's dev and ops. It's developers thinking about ops and ops working with dev. You know, in a lot of organizations, it's the same team. It's the same people. In larger organizations, I don't think we're going to see that fusion. But what you just described is, yeah, the developers need to think about what runtime's going to actually look like. The other comment I wanted to make, and I kind of picked this word up from a Scrum plural site module that I ran a few weeks ago, where you're not actually predicting or estimating, you're forecasting. So you need to forecast what your infrastructure requirements are, but you need to acknowledge that's your best guess. And that you need to be fluid with it. And that's another place where the Service Fabric is so powerful. You need to bring more VMs online into the cluster. You put them on, and then the management layer just rebalances everything, and on you go. Same thing happens when you pull them out. So it's all just done.
So you mentioned that microservices are kind of the cornerstone to this whole mm-hmm. agility thing that you talked about. So does that mean that, you know, hey, all companies should just, you know, stop whatever they're doing and move to microservices? I mean, is this something that is sort of a panacea for all companies?
No. Well, for all companies, yes. For all projects, no.
Yeah.
There are many, many projects where they're not intended to live indefinitely, and you can throw together a website, whether it's Node or ASP.NET. We can avoid that conversation. And just put it up in an app service and run it that way until you need it. You've got moderate scalability in a traditional way. You still, and Evan, you don't need to give up on support for a while, because trust me, the state of the art still needs plenty of help. But so there are plenty of applications like that. Where I do think the microservices approach really needs to come into all these big companies is where they have their big monolithic core systems, and they're just stuck in place. They can't bring the functionality that the business needs in any kind of meaningful time frame. You know, the reason that the mainframes are still out there is it's too expensive to get the software off of it. And so most legacy, you know, back-end business systems are designed poorly. They're not flexible. They're not agile. And they should get on the path to doing it. The discussion about whether you do it in an incremental approach, an evolutionary approach, or whether you start over, you know, it's a case-by-case basis. I do think one of the things the cloud allows, whether it's, you know, public Azure or Azure Stack, or if you want to do a real one on-prem, you know, that does allow you to actually stand up an entire new instantiation of whatever your new system is without impacting your existing system. Whereas in a lot of cases, you've got so much resource buried in that and so much data center taken up with it, it's non-trivial to stand up a new thing. So the cloud definitely makes that a lot more straightforward.
Okay. So it sounds like what you're saying is to really take advantage of the Service Fabric platform and use microservices in the way that they were designed to be used, you should really kind of re-architect your application, right? Or rethink it, to rethink how your application is built.
Yeah. Yeah, and rethink for sure. Re-architecting kind of goes without saying. If you've got a big monolith and you want to do it with a bunch of small things, yeah, that's going to be a re-architecting.
Okay.
And I will say, let me just comment, because it was interesting after you and I did the meeting in New York, I got pulled into a deal at an insurance company up here or a situation, and I just saw their architecture diagram this morning. And in the middle of all of this very traditional-looking stuff, there's a block that's labeled microservices. It didn't even make any sense. So okay. When you talk about rethinking how things are done, yeah, microservices are not just a buzzword you shove in the middle of your architecture. It's a new architecture.
So it's something you need to look at all the way from the front to the back, so to speak.
Yeah, okay. For sure. And then, and this is what I'm advocating, take a look at what you want your to be, and then figure out what a plan, an evolutionary plan from as is to 2B would look like. A big bang, I don't believe. I mean, these are huge projects. I mean, it's taken, you know, years and years for them to get the way they are. And you don't want to be frivolous in how you choose to get to a new form. And you don't want to do a new form just for the sake of doing a new form.
Right. Okay, so, I mean, one way to I'd like to kind of just go into that area is just consider a typical, you know, application that most companies would have, right? Could be mm-hmm. a website with some sort of a middleware, I don't know, SOAP or web services maybe, and some kind of a database or data store in the back end, right?
Right.
Fairly typical three-tier. And I think we all, you know, that's I would consider that to be the traditional model, right? Now, what should people be considering to take something like that and moving it to this microservice service fabric architecture? Walk us through some of the points that they should be thinking about.
Well, so if they're already doing, you know, the web API stuff, okay, so they've kind of got service orientation at that level anyway. To me, where the entire conversation should start is, what are you going to do with your data tier? Because the general thinking is, well, we're doing SQL now, so we'll do SQL tomorrow. Or we're doing SQL now, so let's try this NoSQL thing. And my comment on NoSQL is I'm not keen on things that are defined as by what they're not. But, you know, the power, what we're really bringing here, you know, is this ability to get rid of that data tier bottleneck and everything that goes with it. And so you really want to spend your time thinking about how your data has been partitioned and why it is the way it is and how much of your functionality actually requires relational database functionality, or you're just using it as a state repository. And the vast majority of what is out there is a state repository.
Right. And so if it is a state repository, then go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, if it's state repository, pull it up into the middle tier. That's easy. You know, to the degree you need certain query functions, and from what I even gathered in our conversation a couple of weeks ago, the way NoSQL querying works, we can pretty much do that as queries against the reliable dictionaries. But it is so different for people to think about having their data basically fragmented and next to the compute that you've really got to rework that aspect of it. And then the next part of it is how you do true service orchestration. Right now, having a web API does not a service-oriented architecture make. It's kind of a common sense way to interface to your data and to give you some sort of loose coupling, but we never have, in most organizations, truly achieved any level of service orientation. And then once you've got that mindset in place, then using the service fabric to host your services is very straightforward.
Okay. So, what are some of the other, what kind of models can they use? You mentioned the services, reliable services, obviously, and the dictionary, the reliable dictionary. That's kind of one way. How else can or should they be thinking about re-architecting their applications?
It's the definition of a microservice that we worked on, which is basically it's a single unit of work that can be managed by a small team from birth to death. And when you take those very simple, guidelines, it starts to really direct how you're going to architect those services. And the idea of communicating services rather than just a service interface.
Can you clarify that for me, please?
Well, this is the web API thing, right? So we tend to look at it as our browser-based app or our mobile apps need to come into the back end, and we started to use the REST APIs, to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of got rid of the whole presentation tier on the back end. Yeah, I know there's a lot of MVC out there, and that's fine. But the current thinking is that presentation is all on the client, and then you're just passing data back and forth. So that's fine. But when you actually look at coming into your web tier, and then how the middle tier is orchestrated services, not just a single service function there, because you've got small services, there will be more orchestration. And then you start to get into all the communicating, distributed computing issues that require you to think carefully about your architecture in a different way. What we do now is we just try to avoid it, which is why we get most projects weighed back into the monolithic realm, because it's complicated, so we don't want to do that.
Right.
And my pitch on the whole microservices thing is, yeah, it's complicated, but it's worth it. And Evan, to the point you were saying before, we do tend to yield a bit to the easiest thing to do is what we're already doing.
Right.
But I'm a big fan of quoting Einstein's definition of insanity, which is, if you really want change, but you're going to keep doing what you're already doing, then you're not going to get the change. So either fess up and say you don't really want change, or commit and actually change what you're doing so that you can get a different result.
Yeah, this was, we were talking earlier, kind of joking about, you and I have been in this space forever, right? Back when, mm-hmm. Hey, all we had was PaaS, and we thought that was going to rule the world. And the reality was that the problem became not that PaaS wasn't, if you could write a greenfield app, PaaS was the coolest thing since sliced bread for whole bunches of reasons. But it just didn't work because not everybody wanted to rewrite it. They couldn't. They couldn't do something different yet. Not that they didn't want to. They just couldn't. And so we had to kind of do IaaS and build all that out. But I think you're absolutely right that if you want to get better, you do have to make changes. But anything we can do to make it so the changes are easy or abstracted at only at a certain layer do you see them, like all that kind of stuff. Which I guess that's back to what you're saying about the rough edges. Right, that's the happy medium, right?
Well, I had a long conversation with somebody yesterday about that. Yeah, that would be the theoretical happy medium. I think the word easy Easy and seamless. Those are the two words that I think have been Microsoft's curse for the last 10 years. Because if you're solving complex problems, the solutions are complex. They True. Need to be no more complex than necessary, but they're still complex. And so they're not easy, and they're not seamless. They do require careful thought, as Sujeet was saying about, you know, from the architecture of your software to the architecture of your infrastructure. You need to think about it.
Yep.
And look, I mean, like you said, we've been around a long time. You remember what it used to take to deploy a website into Azure? and now you right click, you hit publish.
Yep.
And all of that stuff we used to have managed manually is all behind the scenes. Yeah, that's wonderful. I like it, but it's not necessary. The big business problems that we can solve with this technology make all of those rough edges worth it. And sure, in 2 or 3 years, they'll all be gone and we'll go, oh, this is nice. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have gotten on the road with this thing now before it's easy.
So what I kind of hear you saying is absolutely right. If you look down the road, right, this is ultimately going to be, we'll call it easy just for the sake of discussion, but today you shouldn't let that, like, this opens up so much capability, so much, you know, ability. You shouldn't let today's rough edges in any way, shape, or form say, I shouldn't start thinking about how to turn what I do today into that just because
right.
of those rough edges.
Yeah, and we're falling into the trap again, because with PaaS V1, I used to have this as one of my punchlines in my presentation. We spend all of our time talking about the 10% of what Azure is not instead of the 90%
yeah.
of what it is.
Yep.
And it's become a culture. As soon as the customers push back, we start to go into that, oh, we need to make it easier, or no, it's not what they want. Well, what they want is what they already know. They tell
yeah.
us that. The yeah. CIOs will say, well, I need for my people to reuse their existing skills. Then you don't want change. So, yeah, I'm all about the push, and Sujeet watched me do it. I actually told these guys, because this was a latest, I'm running into the latest shiny object syndrome.
Yeah.
Our customers want to use the service fabric, but they have no idea what it is. They see the word microservices, and they're supposedly doing microservices like they were all doing private clouds, too, which they didn't. So, you know, when I'm talking to these guys, and they finally, after 4 hours of me trying to talk them out of using the service fabric, no lie, that's what I did, I said, okay, if you want to use the service fabric, then you have to commit to doing things the service fabric way. Those rough edges are where people are trying to use the service fabric to do what they already know how to do. You know, when we describe it as a container platform, the guys, they were putting Node.js in a service fabric container, and it was taking 20 minutes to deploy because they had the whole 200 megabyte image in there.
Yeah.
I'm like, don't do that. And there were two solutions I took to short route, which was, yeah, I wouldn't have told you to do that, because honestly, why not run that in an app service? Why run that in a service fabric container?
Right. So, and that was one of the questions I also had is, you know, would you use Service Fabric for anything other than microservices? Sounds like the answer is you shouldn't.
Certainly at this point, there's no reason to.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have a clear view of where that boundary is. I do know that if you're going to do microservices for real, the Service Fabric is the place to do it. And if you want to run a website, sure. I mean, there are all the articles in the documentation about how to stand that up.
Yeah.
But you can publish to an app service way easier.
Yeah, and then they talk about the guest system, right? What do you call it?
The guest executable.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is,
you know, that's where it started, right?
What?
That's where the service fabric started, was guest executables. It was designed to run the SQL database engine in a container.
I see.
It was the SQL group that built it.
Okay.
Oh, I know. Okay, I know where that came from. I got it.
It was all about, yeah, they needed to be able to leverage Azure Storage for the SQL Azure
yep.
data store.
Yep, I remember that now.
Did you ever do a data center tour?
No, but yeah, I
There used to be, so the first, I saw the Chicago data center and we're walking along and all this in there, like, this is all Azure from this point to the end of the room. It's a big space. And I'm looking, there's a gigantic EMC SAN sitting in the middle of everything. I'm like, what's that? I said, oh, that's SQL Azure.
Yeah, so.
So that wasn't scalable.
The, yeah, I don't think I'm going to get in trouble for this later, but this goes back to one of the not well-known things about the, original version of SQL Azure. Not so customers, end users, not true today. So full disclaimer there, not true today, was it was bare metal. Parts of it were bare metal because we couldn't do it on the quote-unquote Azure, right? And I'm sure that's part of what you were seeing there, right?
Yeah, it was a SQL database farm with a multi-tenant front end.
Yeah, that was
what it was. And you remember? Do you know why we built it?
Some of the things I know about why we built it, I don't want to talk about either.
Well,
you may have some things you can share. I'll get in trouble.
Yeah. Now, in the CTP year from fall of 2008 to fall of 2009, the customer feedback was they love the zero admin of the compute instances. They wanted a similar database solution.
Oh, well, we were talking about when we went from SSDS.
Well, why we built SSDS.
Yeah,
built SDS in the first place.
Yep.
All right. SDS for the new kids on the block is SQL Data Services is what it was originally called.
Yeah.
So we did that. Most of those applications needed relatively small databases, which is why we did 1 gig and 10 gig, because the next cluster was at a terabyte, and we knew we couldn't do that and hit the theoretical needs. And then over time, I was actually studying up on SQL Database Today. It's amazing how far we've come with it.
Yeah.
But anyway, we've digressed from the service fabric.
Yeah. So Mark, I wanted to just take before we wind up, I wanted to get your feedback on actors and the actor framework, which is I know you have a lot to say about that as well. Like, how does that fit into your definition of the service fabric way?
So I personally think the actors are where it gets really, really cool. Okay, but, and I'm told to be careful at Microsoft about talking about this, but the computer science of actors needs to be well understood before you even attempt to architect an application this way. With normal microservices, you'll build, that orchestration thing I was talking about, you build a graph of microservices. And in the actor model, you should build a graph of actors, and I just got mine working literally this past week after working on it for several months part-time. I got it working. And it's really cool, but it was really hard, and it required an immense amount of discipline and an immense amount of basically just desire to make it work. I discovered where the real rough edges are. There's something that they've implemented in the actor framework that I want to have a deep discussion with them on why they did it that way. The answers I'm getting so far are not satisfactory. It was kind of like, because it makes certain things easier, and I'm like, but it breaks the whole model, or it allows people to easily break the model, and that you don't want to do, Evan, to your point about implementation ease.
Got it.
So it's very neat. The current guidance is don't try to do a graph of actors. But you're not doing actors at that point. So we kind of need to decide, do we see the value in actors and we want to take it forward? And to give you an idea, when you think about one of the things really neat, because when we talk about bringing the data tier up into the compute tier, when you look at an actor as representing a record, and then you can have millions of actors all representing all of the records that would have been stored in a table, you get into some really interesting patterns at that point, things that can really change how things are done.
Yeah.
So, and I guess this brings up another thought on the thinking of what you have to accept. And this is how we got here. This is why we do this. When you do cloud things, you're talking about tens of thousands of servers, of VMs, okay? you can no longer afford to manage those as individual units, which is what enterprise scale is. They do big things. If you guys have been around a while, you remember when enterprise was the big thing. Okay, and then web scale made that look like a joke, and now the hyperscale thing has pushed it even further away. But that mentality is you will manage and control each and every image that's in your data center, and that's not feasible. And so you got to get comfortable with you're not going to know everything that's going on in every machine at any moment. Things are going to fail, and they're going to come back up on their own. And they're going to log when that happens, and then somebody's going to eventually fix that. But that's the way things work now. It's not the old admin, sysadmin approach.
Got it. That's very, very insightful, Mark. Thank you. Guys, any more questions for Mark before we wind up today's session?
No, on top of the nice trip down memory lane, this is great. This opens my eyes a little bit. I'm going to have to go spend some more time definitely digging into Service Fabric.
Okay. Yeah, and if you want to just have a one-on-one conversation about that, I'd be glad to do that. One of the things, you know, for all of us that work with customers at Microsoft, we need to lead them on this. This, you know, and if a customer comes and says, yeah, we want to look, you know, we're thinking of doing the Service Fabric, we need to tell them all the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And,
that's fair.
Yeah,
that's
it's, fair. It's trying to make it out like it's easy to do. I mean, it makes a lot of things easier, but then you need to do things the Service Fabric way, and that's still complicated, but it's worth it. That's what I end with.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate your time that you took. I know we kept you on pretty late here today, and we'll have to get you on sometime in the future when Service Fabric, you know, has hit critical mass and see how the discussion has changed.
Sure. Yeah, this was fun. Thank you. I appreciate your asking me.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Mark.
Yep, thanks Mark.
Guys. Take care.
Okay, bye, guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.